I'm sorry. It must have been hard to go a whole week without these beautiful lectures, but don't worry, the nightmare is over. Are there any questions before I start today? Okay. So last time we were talking about single field slow roll inflation, which can be written down in one line with this action. And we talked about the background solution. It was parameterized by a function of time, infoton field value that depends on time and a scale factor with the equations of motion. This equation of motion for the infoton, and then for the and then for the scale factor, we had Friedmann's equations with this, where we worked out the form of the energy density rho for single field inflation. And we were in the process of analyzing the perturbations. I'll write linear perturbations since everything is going to be to first order. So, phi equals 5r plus some delta phi. And analogously for the metric. Metric is an FRW background plus a general perturbation. And we're actually in the middle of talking about gauge fixing. And I'd written down this gauge choice, the unitary gauge, where you make a coordinate transformation to set the inflaton perturbation to zero. And then for the metric perturbation, I guess I need a couple lines. First, I want to, this first line is a defines a change of variables, not a gauge choice. I'll write the spatial perturbation as the sum of a trace term and a traceless term. Where, the trace of gamma is equal to zero. And then the unitary gauge is defined by two gauge conditions, delta phi equals zero, and this gauge condition that says that the divergence of gamma, if you like, is equal to zero. So we had written this down, and I just want to finish the discussion of the gauge by proving that starting from an arbitrary set of perturbations, there exists a unique gauge transformation or coordinate transformation that brings the perturbations into unitary gauge. That's plausible at the level of counting degrees of freedom, since a gauge transformation is parameterized by a four vector field. Here there are four gauge conditions. This is one equation, this is three equations for the free index I. But I want to just show that that really, prove a little more rigorously that that really works out. So first, I'll write out what I'm doing. So I'll show that. Let's show that for arbitrary starting from arbitrary perturbations, there exists a unique gauge transformation epsilon mu such that the gauge condition star is satisfied. Okay. So to show that, I'm going to use some transformation laws that I didn't fully derive. The second one is partially derived on the problem set. Under a gauge transformation that takes parameterized by epsilon mu, then if you write out the transformation law for delta phi, and also for this quantity, the divergence of gamma ij, then this is what you get. And the second one is a homework problem. I'm going to phrase the theorem that I'm trying to prove this way. That I'd like to show that the equations have a unique solution for an arbitrary set of sources on the right hand side. So to show that these differential equations, I guess the first one's not a differential equation. To show that these equations have a unique solution for an arbitrary right hand side, then the first thing I'll do is go to Fourier space, where the equations can be written this way. Let me put K on everything. There's one for I could. And then the advantage of Fourier space is that each K mode is independent. That's generally true for a set of linear equations with the satisfy translation invariants. So I can analyze these equations one Fourier mode at a time. And if I am just thinking about a single Fourier mode, I'll choose coordinates so that the Fourier wave number of interest points in the z direction. And then in those coordinates, the equations look like this linear system. So then the theorem that I'm trying to prove it follows because this matrix is invertible. So then there's a unique solution epsilon for every S. Okay, so that mostly concludes discussion of the gauge. I just want to make a few more comments. There were some really fun questions last time about how is it that if the inflaton is driving the physics, then you can choose a gauge where the inflaton is zero? I thought that was an interesting question. So I want to draw this picture. So first, let me say that it's possible to choose a different gauge where the inflaton is not gauged away. For example, you could choose, this gauge has a name, the spatially flat gauge. You could choose a gauge where there's no trace part in the spatial part of the metric. Um, the metric purely looks like a gamma term where gamma is traceless and its divergence is zero. So generally in the spatially flat gauge, there will be a perturbation in the inflaton field. Now this is supposed to be a picture of space-time sliced up by two different time coordinates. The time coordinate of unitary gauge, where surfaces of constant time are the same as surfaces where the inflaton field value is constant, or you're using phi as the clock. And then the dashed line is the spatially flat gauge, where an observer that uses this surface as a surface of constant time will see an inflaton perturbation, but they will not see a trace term in their metric. The spatially flat gauge is named this way because if you consider the three geometry formed by a spatial hypersurface, then the scalar curvature is zero. So in general, those time slicings will be different. I'll denote by delta t the time difference between them. And both observers agree that delta t is not zero, that there's some difference between their slicings. Like that's a statement that's true in any gauge. The observer that uses the unitary gauge will experience that time difference, or rather h times the time difference, as the metric perturbation in their coordinate system. An observer which uses the spatially flat gauge will experience delta t as, minus phi dot times delta t, as an inflaton perturbation along their time slice. So the gauge invariant statement is just that you can't satisfy both gauge conditions at once, that there's some time difference between the time slicings that you get. But you can choose to put that gauge invariant quantity delta t, depending on your choice of coordinates, you can choose to put it into the trace part of the metric, or you can choose to represent it as an inflaton perturbation. If there were no inflaton, then there would be no like dynamical scalar degree of freedom in the theory, and it would not be possible to draw a picture like this. You just had gravity. I personally think the spatially flat gauge is more intuitive. Like since the inflaton is driving the physics and is responsible for the scalar degree of freedom, it just feels more natural to make the inflaton be the perturbation variable. It just happens to be the case that when you work out the equations of motion and so on, that the physics is simpler, algebraically simpler in the unitary gauge. So because I've worked out the equations both ways, I decided to use the unitary gauge. Next I want to talk about the physics of the perturbations. So in unitary gauge, the general perturbation can be written this way. Remember, I haven't enforced any gauge condition on G00 or G0i. I should say in advance that the next few blackboards are I'm going to skip over some of the details of the derivations because the algebra here is really painful. Then I'll write delta phi equals zero. Okay.
So here we are just redefining what A and B are. What
it just. Oh, right. These are definitions. These equations just define the fields A and B. I haven't imposed any gauge conditions on these components of the metrics, so these are just general fields. If I were to count degrees of freedom at this point, I end up with 7. There's one for A, 3 for B, 1 for zeta, and then 2 for the object gamma ij, which we, last time I counted the degrees of freedom of gamma with the conditions that its trace is 0. It's symmetric, its trace is 0, and its divergence is 0. Then gamma ends up having 2 degrees of freedom, which you can interpret as the degrees of freedom of a propagating gravity wave, for a total of 7 degrees of freedom. Based on general discussion from last time, we expect that when we find Einstein's equations for these perturbations, that 4 of these degrees of freedom will turn out to be non-dynamical. And that is indeed the case. So I'm going to write down Einstein's equations. Now, I think there's a general theorem that says that all calculations in GR are either like half a page or 20 pages. And this is a calculation of the 20-page variety. So if you take this metrics, so for calculations like this, I won't try to go through it on the blackboard. I tried doing it just for my own benefit when I was prepping the lecture, and I just I got bogged down. I didn't finish. But the answer is in papers, of course. Anyway, just to, I will. So for calculations like this, I'll describe the setup and then say what the answer is. And the setup is just taking these 7 perturbation variables and then plugging into the Einstein equation of motion, g mu nu equals t mu nu, where t mu nu has the single field inflation form that we derived for a general phi. T mu nu over m Planck squared. And then the equation of motion for the inflaton, which is delta squared phi plus m phi equals 0. Where this is the covariant for Laplacian in the perturbed metric, so it will depend on the perturbation variables. Even though phi doesn't in unitary gauge. And then just working out by a lot of algebra the equations of motion. Then after a lot of algebra, this is what you get. And the main point I want to make is just that. The equations of motion for A and BI do not have time derivatives. Let me also say that this is a really painful amount of algebra if you are doing it directly from Einstein's equations, but it's not as bad if you're familiar with the ADM formulation for GR. The ADM formulation has the advantage that the non-dynamical degrees of freedom, in this case A and BI, manifestly have equations of motion without time derivatives, rather than that emerging from what looks like an algebraic accident. Anyway, the equations of motion for zeta and gamma are sort of interesting. Like they look like wave equations with some interesting dynamics. Squared. Let's do del squared. Whereas,
what is that delta minus 2?
Oh, yeah, sorry. For some reason, it's. This one really is delta to the minus 2. This one was wrong in my notes, so I got had a little.
What does delta to the minus 2 mean?
You should really interpret it in K space.
Ah, okay.
Delta to the minus 2. Like it is the inverse spatial Laplacian. You should really interpret it as a factor of minus whatever K squared in for K space.
In this case, everywhere the file we have is only time dependent, right? It has no spatial dependence.
Oh yeah, that's true. Right. So between here and here, I guess I without saying it explicitly, I stopped distinguishing notationally between like phi bar dot and phi dot, just because I'm working in the unitary gauge where there's no difference. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. Okay. So anyway, the point is that you can forget about A and BI. They're not dynamical quantities. They're values on a time slice. They're just determined by what the other fields are doing. Consider zeta and gamma, which satisfy sort of normal looking second order wave equations as being like the degrees of freedom of single field Sorel inflation. Now it happens that in order to quantize this theory, I'll need slightly more information than Einstein's equations, the equations of motion to first order in the perturbation variables. I'll also need the action to second order. They're almost equivalent. Like if you vary the action to second order, you get the equations of motion to first order. But the action does contain an overall normalization, which matters quantum mechanically, but not classically. So here, this is another 20-page calculation that I'm just going to summarize. I just want to make sure it's like conceptually clear how the calculation is set up. Conceptually, the way that you do this calculation is you take the action for this theory, and it has to be the total action, including both the Einstein-Hilbert term and the action for the inflaton. Since the kinetic term for the inflaton hides a factor of g upper mu nu, then it does have dependence on the metric perturbations, even though the inflaton is unperturbed in the unitary gauge. And then what I'm going to do is plug in this form of the metric and expand the action to second order in the perturbation variables. But I'm going to take the non-dynamical degrees of freedom and put them on shell, in the sense that everywhere where A and BI appear in the action, I'll replace them by the right-hand sides, so that I just have the action for the dynamical degrees of freedom for the theory. So it's sort of a partially on-shell action in the sense that the non-dynamical variables are on-shell. They're assumed to satisfy their equations of motion. But the dynamical fields, zeta and gamma, are not. So after a truly gigantic amount of calculation, you can end up with what's called the Sasaki-Mukunov action. In the rest of the discussion of single field inflation, I'm just going to forget about the original action and just sort of treat this as being an action for the theory. It's the action in terms of the 3 degrees of freedom that, you know, eventually emerge as the dynamical quantities. The first line is the equation of motion for a scalar quantity zeta. And the second line is the action for these gravity wave-like degrees of freedom gamma, right? Mukunov Sasaki action. One comment is that it's a pure quadratic in the perturbation variables. There's no term which is linear in the perturbation variables. And that's because I'm assuming that I'm perturbing around a background that satisfies the classical equations of motion, which means since the classical equations of motion are derived by varying the action, then that means whenever we expand around that action, the term which is linear in the perturbation variables always ends up being zero. there's a consistency between the second order action and the first order equations of motion. If you vary, in fact, the action has been written in a way where if you vary it, then you manifestly get these equations of motion. But the action contains slightly more information because it contains normalizing constants like this factor of m Planck's 1 squared over 8, which matter quantum mechanically. One quick conceptual way to see that the normalization of the action matters quantum mechanically is that, you know, if I have a path integral of the form e to the I action over h bar, and changing the normalization of the action is equivalent to changing the size of h bar and increasing or decreasing the strength of quantum mechanical effects. Okay. So that's all that I have to say about a classical physics of inflation. Like, we ended up with the equations of motion for the background. And then, unfortunately, I had to skip some of the calculations since they're quite long. But we ended up with the equations of motion and the action for the perturbation variables. So for the rest of the lectures, I'm going to talk about how you quantize this action and the very interesting physics that emerges quantum mechanically. I'm going to start, I think 2.5 lectures will be about right. So I'm going to switch gears to quantum mechanics. One advanced comment is that this action is quadratic in the perturbation variables. And so it describes a free QFG, which is usually a pretty trivial thing. Like, there are no diagrams, just propagators. Except that what's unusual about this free QFG is that the action has explicit time dependence. That will introduce some new features like particle production. So we're going to be talking about free QFTs. I'll do several examples of free quantum field theories, but with time-dependent Hamiltonians. As my first example, just to like totally warm up, I'm just going to talk about the time-dependent simple harmonic oscillator. I think in every physics class, it's traditional for the lecturer to like start with the harmonic oscillator and slowly turn it into whatever they want to talk about. And so I'm gonna stick with this tradition. And as my setup, and it's not really very different here. I mean, at a free QFT, like, each K mode evolves independently. And so if we wrote this action in Fourier space, each K mode would be like, you know, some sort of harmonic oscillator with like a time dependent mass and frequency. Consider an ordinary quantum mechanics, this Hamiltonian, where I'm going to assume that the frequency omega t is just some prescribed function of time, but I'm going to assume that at early times it approaches some constant omega naught. And then I'm going to assume that at early times, when omega is constant, and the usual description of a harmonic oscillator with ladder operators applies, that we start in the ground state. That's in the ground state of the oscillator. Now, one thing that will happen is that in a time-dependent harmonic oscillator, you can leave the ground state. Just for fun, let me mention that there are a couple of limits where you can sort of figure out what's going to happen. Like, if omega is changed slowly enough, meaning that the change in omega is small compared, I guess this should be omega squared, small compared to omega squared, then the time dependence of the Hamiltonian is adiabatic, which means that if the system is prepared in the ground state, it would stay in the ground state. But then there's an opposite regime where the change in omega is rapid, like, let's say it's instantaneous and has a step function in it, then Schrodinger's equation does not permit the the wave function to evolve discontinuously. So the wave function has to stay constant as that when the Hamiltonian crosses the step. And then what will happen is you'll get a an excited state. Like if I start in the ground state, which is Gaussian, whose width is determined by omega. I think it's omega minus x squared over 2, something like that. Didn't look it up before the lecture. Then when omega is changed, the new ground state of the oscillator would be a Gaussian with a different width. And the old ground state wave function now corresponds to an excited state. So it's easy to see conceptually that if I change omega rapidly enough, I can leave the ground state and get to some interesting excited state of the oscillator. Okay, and just to give myself something concrete to compute, let's say that the goal is to compute the at some later time t and for an arbitrary function omega of t. Then my goal is to compute the variance of the wave function or the expectation value of x squared at some late time t. Now there's a simple recipe. I'll write down the answer and then I'll show how it's derived. Which is that if I define the complex function u of t, by integrating the classical equation of motion for the oscillator, with this initial condition at early times, it should go as e to the minus, where omega is a constant omega naught. It should look like this, e to the minus I omega naught t over 2 and square root of 2 omega naught. That classical, that's the solution to the classical equations of motion determines all of the quantum mechanical expectation values at late times. In particular, this variance turns out to be the square of the classical mode function.
This solution is not for the set equation written above, right? This is the if omega was time independent, then this would be the solution.
Oh, at early times.
Okay, I don't
know. So at early times, I'm assuming that omega is constant. But the equation of motion is more complicated, and this prescription for the variance applies, exactly even at late times with arbitrary time dependence. So your first thought when looking at this, so this is what I want to do, your first thought might be to solve the Schrodinger equation, and it is possible to. Do it this way, but I want to. It's sort of more natural and also generalizes better to QFT. You use the Heisenberg picture. Just to make sure, like the foundations are clear, I want to just briefly review the. No, I was worried that I'm doing too much review, but I think it's never bad. So it's just something I need to get over. Let me just briefly review the Schrodinger and Heisenberg pictures in quantum mechanics. The Schrodinger picture centers around the evolution of a wave function via Schrodinger's equation. I'll write Schrodinger's equation this way, where I've put the S subscript on the Hamiltonian just to emphasize that it's the Schrodinger picture Hamiltonian, and I'm allowing it to be time dependent. You can describe the evolution of Schrodinger's equation using a so-called the unitary evolution upward. So this equation defines, you want a unitary evolution operator that takes you from some initial time zero to the wave function at some time t. This operator would be if h is time independent, then it's e to the minus ah times the time difference. But for a general h of t, it won't be given by this simple formula. I guess you could always write it as the time ordered exponential e to the minus ih, but I wouldn't actually use that formula. Okay, so that's my two line summary of the Schrodinger picture. And then the Heisenberg picture. First, I want to define a Heisenberg operator. So given any Schrodinger picture operator O sub S, the corresponding Heisenberg picture operator O sub H is defined like this. The definition is design.
Schrodinger picture at t zero, or that is supposed to be time independent, right?
Well, I'm not going to allow my Schrodinger picture operators to be time dependent. Like here, OS means any operator in the Schrodinger picture where I want to compute like an expectation value of the operator at some time t.
So it's usually when we learn the two pictures, it's like in the Schrodinger picture, we keep the operators time independent and evolve the state.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure if, I don't think I have any examples in the lecture. But like a situation where it might be useful would be in the time-dependent oscillator. Let me say that in the time-dependent, now that I think about it, this comes up in one of the homework problems. So in the or the time-dependent harmonic oscillator, I guess there are two notions of lowering operator. There's the operators x and p do not have time dependence. But suppose you were interested in counting particles at some time t, then you would use
omega would be time dependent.
Yeah. Like if I wanted to count particles by computing the expectation value of the operator A dagger A, then I would want to use this operator in the Schrodinger picture, which would depend on time.
Yeah.
Like this is the appropriate operator for counting particles in the oscillator at time t. And this is different from the Heisenberg picture operator. Which is related to this by factors of the unitary evolution operator, and is not the same operator. So this would be the operator that I would use if I wanted to count particles at time t by doing a computation with the initial on the initial wave. Okay. So the Schrodinger and Heisenberg pictures are defined so that if I'm trying to compute an expectation value in quantum mechanics of this, you know, schematic form, then The way that's computed in the Schrodinger picture is like this. I guess I'll keep the time dependence on the OS. And in the Heisenberg picture, you put you move time dependence from the out of the wave function and into the operator. In the most common case where this operator OS does not depend on time, then in the Schrodinger picture, you leave the operator fixed and you're evolving the wave function. And in the Heisenberg picture, it's the opposite. You leave the wave function fixed and you evolve the operators. So Heisenberg's picture of quantum mechanics was one where you take equations of motion for every classical quantity in sight, replace them by the corresponding differential equations for operators, and then figure out how to solve those operators given in the presence of some canonical commutation relations like this one. One more thing that I should write down is the Heisenberg equation of motion. And on a different blackboard, I guess. Which has the time derivative of a Heisenberg picture operator? There's this term. There's the commutator term. One way of writing it is like this. Commutator of the operator OH with the Heisenberg picture Hamiltonian. And then there's a term which is usually absent if the Schrodinger picture operator does not depend on time. It comes from time dependence of OS. And I'll write that term this way. I take the time derivative of OS and then Heisenbergize that operator according to this general definition. And then one last comment is that the process of Heisenbergization, there's got to be a better thing to call on. Commutes with multiplication of operators or commutators. So that if I wanted to, I could compute this commutator by commuting Schrodinger picture operators and then Heisenbergizing afterwards. I made the mistake of writing on the backboard. And in particular, this property implies that the canonical commutator is still equal to I in the Heisenberg picture. Because I could have computed it in the Schrodinger picture first, which means I'll go over here. So as an example, which is which is nice because everything's really easy to solve explicitly, is the time dependent oscillator with omega zero. I'm gonna work out formulas for the Heisenberg picture operators, X and P. And let me first remind you that for the harmonic oscillator, if I were to write down the Schrodinger versions of these operators, usually most convenient to use ladder operators. Okay. Now, in figuring out what to write on the right-hand side in the Heisenberg picture, let me first start by Heisenbergizing the lowering operator A. So one approach, so it'll turn out that this is what you get. And one way of seeing that, so the Heisenberg operator, lowering operator, just has this extra phase. One way of seeing that is to use the Heisenberg equation of motion. H dot equals I. To compute that commutator, I'll write H in terms of, let's see. I'm going to compute this commutator in the Schrodinger picture and then Heisenberg eyes at the end. I'll write the commutator this way. There's a 1/2 omega naught. And then when I commute with this term, I get minus I omega naught AS. The A dagger is 1. So the equation of motion. Takes this simple form, which implies that the time dependence goes as e to the I omega naught times t, or rather t minus t. That's one way. Another way of seeing it, which I think is really useful. Well, let me come back to that at the end. If I take the Hermitian conjugate on both sides of the equation, then of course I get this. Yes, S day. And now to get the Heisenberg picture operators X and P. If I just Heisenbergize both sides of this equation, like put u on the left and multiply by u on the left and u dagger on the left and u on the right, then I get this. It'll be useful in a minute to have these up. And then for P8P. keep those up for the time dependent case that I'll do in a minute. I think it's also like useful to point out that this time dependence for a Heisenberg picture operator with e to the minus omega times time is what's called positive frequency. The other time dependence is called negative frequency. Just bring this up since you should remember that positive frequency means that you have a minus sign. In general, you expect positive frequency for an operator which decreases energy for the following reason. I have any operator which like the lowering operator A. Any operator which lowers energy, then this is a second way of deriving the e to the minus I omega t. You can go back, instead of using the Heisenberg equation of motion, you can go back to the definition of the Heisenberg picture operator. I'm asking what happens if I apply the Heisenberg picture operator to an arbitrary state with energy E. And here I'll get E to the minus. Well, I guess I am assuming here a time independent Hamiltonian for this argument. Here, when I multiply, when I evolve an energy eigenstate, I'll get e to the minus IE times the time difference. And then bring that out in front. Okay. Now, when I multiply a dagger by a state with energy E minus delta E, I'll get E to the plus IE minus delta E minus T zero. And now if I combine both of these phases, I get E to the minus I delta E. E minus T zero AS E. So this argument gives another way to see that the Heisenberg picture operator is related to the Schrodinger picture operator by this positive frequency phase. This operator equation is true because we showed it was true when applied to an arbitrary energy eigenstate. And a general state can be built as a linear combination of energy eigenstates. Anyway, that's why the energy lowering operators have this positive frequency in the Heisenberg picture. Energy raising operators have the opposite sign, the negative frequency. And an operator like X or P, which is a mixture of an energy lowering and an energy raising part, has both positive frequency and negative frequency components. Okay. Well, we're basically ready to do the time dependent oscillator, which is not very different from the time independent oscillator. But I can't quite do it in 2 minutes, so I should stop here for today.